I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. Well, it's officially summer, when the days are long and our time is dependent on a variety of camp schedules, swimming lessons, ballet classes, outdoor concerts, and impromptu scooter adventures. Nish and I have one more episode of Impolite Company left before we break for a more relaxed summer schedule. But don't fret. We're starting a newsletter to keep you up to date on religion and politics news while we're gone and throughout the year. Make sure to tune in next week for information on how to sign up. And if you aren't already subscribed to the podcast, please make sure you do so via your preferred podcast app. That way you'll know when we start the next season. And if there's something we feel we absolutely have to comment on over the summer, you won't miss it. Today we're going to run two conversations I recorded recently with a pair of truly impressive women. Rachel Lazar is a legal expert who walked me through fights over religious liberty in the courts overall, and the Masterpiece Cake decision from the Supreme Court in particular. And Julie Rogers, who's a popular writer and speaker on issues related to LGBT Christians, talked about the years she spent in gay conversion therapy in evangelical settings, and what it was like to march in her first Pride Parade earlier this month. Rachel Lazar is the head of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, and she's a woman who is impossible to pigeonhole. You may have heard her speaking on the steps of the Supreme Court this week, protesting the ruling on Trump's travel ban. Rachel is a lawyer who started her career at the National Women's Law Center and sits on the board of NARAL. But I got to know her during the years she worked at the centrist think tank, Third Way. There, she started an initiative bringing together evangelical Christians and liberals. And she also spearheaded an innovative common ground approach to reducing abortion rates. Not many people can say that. This spring, Rachel took over Americans United following the retirement of Barry Lynn, who had led the organization for 25 years. The only thing I know for sure about what she'll do in her new role is that it won't be what anyone expects. When she and I spoke, it was not long after the Supreme Court issued a very specific, very narrow ruling on the Masterpiece Cake case, and she talked me through it. So Rachel, thank you so much for joining us this week. We knew that we wanted to talk about the Masterpiece case, but we also knew that we felt not quite up to expertise level in being able to figure out what's going on. So first, I was hoping you could give us just a quick overview of what the court said on Monday.
Sure. While the court reversed the lower court's decision and sided with the bakery, right? A lot of people say the baker, but in fact, the petitioner was Masterpiece Cake Shop. So that's who the court decided with. Of course, it's owned by Jack Phillips, who is a baker who had refused refused to create a wedding cake for Charlie Craig and David Mullen's wedding. And the court said that they were reversing the lower court decision on the grounds that there had been religious bias in the commission, the civil rights, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission's hearing of the case. Therefore, while the court agreed that a business that is open has to be open to all, they felt that there had been animus towards the religion of the baker in the hearing by the Civil Rights Commission. And on that ground, reversed the lower court's decision in favor of Charlie and Dave.
Okay. Just to make sure that we're all on the same page understanding this, does the reversal mean that they're saying, yes, it's okay for a baker to refuse to make a cake for someone citing his own religious beliefs?
Absolutely not. In fact, the court made clear that, and I'll quote here, that it is a general rule that religious and philosophical objections do not allow business owners to deny protected persons equal access to goods and services under a neutral and generally applicable public accommodations law, which is what the court found the Colorado anti-discrimination law to be, a neutral and generally applicable public accommodations non-discrimination law. Okay. So that was very clear as well. And in that sense, the fact that the seven justices who were behind this opinion included all of the conservative justices on the court, in that sense, it was a victory of sorts.
In what way?
Because the court made clear that a business that is open has to be open to all, because the court made clear that that there is a rule that says that your religious views do not allow you to deny protected persons equal access to goods and services in your business. Mm-hmm. That's a victory of sorts because many of the justices that were part of the 7-2 majority opinion are conservative justices who signed off on an opinion that made that so clear that in its closing paragraph, and I will quote, just flip to it, the court said that disputes such as this one in Masterpiece must be resolved, quote, without subjecting LGBTQ persons to indignities when they seek goods and services in an open market.
Hmm.
And that's a direct quote from the majority opinion written by Kennedy, Justice Kennedy.
So that's fascinating in that it has not been the takeaway of most of the coverage of the decision. How is it that something like this, which, you know, I think it's fair to say it was one of the more anticipated cases that people were waiting to see what the court would do this year. How is it that people are able to take away conclusions seemingly from all sides?
Well, it's confusing. You know, it's confusing that in the end, and it's not confusing, I guess, it's a reality that in the end, the court reversed the opinion of the lower court in favor of Charlie Craig and David Mullins and sided with Masterpiece Cake Shop. So in other words, it invalidated the finding, you know, of the commission mm-hmm. that Jack Phillips, the baker, and the on behalf of the bakery had violated the non-discrimination law, right? So that's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Point number two is something that Justice Ginsburg talked about in her dissent with Justice Sotomayor, which is, you know, the court found some statements of commissioners on the Colorado Civil Rights Commission to suggest a type of animus towards religion that would interfere with the concept that someone had a fair hearing in the way that the court requires. Right. Mm-hmm. And Justice Ginsburg and Sotomayor feel that what the commissioner, like, for example, one of the statements that the commissioner made wasn't worthy of being deemed anti-religion. And we can talk about that. And they also felt that there were so many layers of decision makers before this came to the Supreme Court who all found in favor of Charlie and Dave, including the Colorado Civil Rights Division, where the complaint started, the administrative law judge who next heard the case, the Colorado Commission on Civil Rights, which we've been talking about, where there was this allegation, and then the Colorado Court of Appeals, which had to hear the case de novo, anew, that it's nonsensical to say that the remarks of two commissioners during various hearings at various times would create sufficient animus to say that this case was decided on the basis of hostility towards religion and therefore needed to be invalidated. So there are definitely victories besides just the fact, which is a big victory, that the court reversed the Colorado Court of Appeals.
Now, I'm interested in, as you said, we can interpret the statements differently and their import of what two of the folks on the Civil Rights Commission, is that right, in Colorado, said. It does strike me that people across the ideological spectrum should, in theory, be able to agree that you don't want people, particularly on a civil rights commission, to be expressing animus on the basis of someone's religion or gender or race or ethnicity. But what was kind of at issue about the content of these particular statements?
Well, I'm very glad you asked, because I will read you part of a quote, a direct quote, from one of the commissioners that Justice Kennedy cited in his opinion. And, you know, he doesn't identify the commissioner, but he says in his opinion, the commissioner stated, freedom of religion and religion has been used to justify all kinds of discrimination throughout history, whether it be slavery, whether it be the Holocaust, whether it be, I mean, we can list hundreds of situations where freedom of religion has been used to justify discrimination. And to me, the commissioner continues, and this is the last part of the quote, it is one of the most despicable pieces of rhetoric that people can use to use their religion to hurt others. Okay, so let's talk about that quote, okay? Because that is one of the main facts that this opinion centers itself around when it declares that there was animus. The next sentence in Justice Kennedy's opinion after that block quote says, to describe a man's faith as, quote, one of the most despicable pieces of rhetoric that people can use, close quote, is to disparage his religion. And then it goes on. I read the quote, I read what the commissioner said to say that it is despicable, and this is a direct quote, to use religion to hurt others, not someone's religion is despicable.
Right.
Now, perhaps, you know, and so the court parsed it very differently. Okay. The majority opinion parses that very differently. But I think it's very fair to say that it would be an accurate representation of history and the reality, maybe one that's hard to consume, that slavery and the Holocaust, but slavery too, was in many ways justified religiously, you know, based on religious beliefs. And right now, what's so interesting is that the same lawyers that brought the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, which are lawyers at a group called Alliance Defending Freedom, which the Southern Poverty Law Center has called and labeled a hate group, by the way, that those same lawyers, right after this opinion, used this opinion to say that there was a similar animus that calls for sort of invalidating an opinion as well, in a very related case that is right now waiting to see whether the Supreme Court is going to hear it or not, is going to grant certiorari or not. And that's a case about a flower shop in Washington state that denied flowers for a wedding, for a same-sex wedding. And what's so interesting is, based on this interpretation that Justice Kennedy and the seven, you know, justices together made of that commissioner's quote that I read you, that now the same legal group, which is called a hate group, is saying that the Attorney General of Washington, right, who's suing Arlene's Flowers in Washington state, had that same animus that calls for a reversal of that opinion. You know why? In part, they say, because he related this type of discrimination of Arlene's Flowers towards a same-sex couple to past cases of racial discrimination.
And just simply and making that comparison, they say, is expressing animus.
That's exactly right, right? Because this court, in its opinion, talked about likening instances where religion was used to discriminate to slavery and the Holocaust. Now, Alliance Defending Freedom is saying, well, the Washington, they issued this yesterday, that the a statement, well, the Washington Attorney General also related this behavior of the Laurel shop to racial discrimination, and therefore it's basing its the government, the Washington state, the Attorney General is inappropriately bringing hostility towards religion into its case, and needs to be, its case also needs to be invalidated on that basis.
That sounds like it's coming pretty close to saying you can't bring the historical record into it.
To me, that's true, because many people know it, many lawyers know it, most African Americans know it, but there certainly is a tradition in this country of using religion to discriminate against people of color. And, you know, you can look at the Bob Jones University case, where that university said that they weren't going to admit African American students because it was against their religious beliefs to have interracial dating.
Right.
And, you know, there's another famous case, which actually this opinion, the Masterpiece Cake Shop opinion, cites about Piggy Park, which is about a barbecue restaurant that refused to serve African Americans based on the owner's religious beliefs. That was right where the court found that that wasn't permissible. So there's plenty of evidence. And actually, it continues. There's a recent report out of an institute at Columbia University that talks about how Catholic hospitals are refusing services based on their religious beliefs to women, like abortion and sterilization, but finding exceptions for white women that they're not finding for women of color. In fact, that religion continues to sort of play a role in discrimination against people of color even today. And, you know, so that's something that's really important to remember when you're reading this opinion.
Right. So where does this leave us as we wrap up this conversation in terms of going forward? As you said, it seems like the majority decision, among other things, seem to be saying it's not okay to use your religion to deny these kinds of services to these kinds of groups. But is there still an opening for another test case, or a need for a test case that could establish that definitively?
For sure. There's many cases that are out there right now, including this Arlene Flowers case that we just talked about, that are, you know, potentially going to be heard by the court. And it feels like it's a matter of time. So Alliance Defending Freedom, which we spoke about earlier, this hate group, which has a budget of $50 million, is deliberately bringing a series of cases on behalf of businesses that want to use religion as a basis to discriminate against people who are gay or lesbian or queer, against transgender people, and also against women. So another case that will be coming down soon in this session from the Supreme Court, from the U.S. Supreme Court, is this NIFLA versus Becerra case, which is a challenge to a California law requiring crisis pregnancy centers, or really fake women's health clinics, to post signs about the comprehensive reproductive health care services that the state provides. That's another case that was brought by Alliance Defending Freedom. They brought a case against a funeral home that wanted to fire an employee that transitioned, who was transgender. So they brought a case that they brought the Arlene Flowers case. They brought a case on behalf of a photography business that refused to do a same-sex couple's wedding. I mean, there's numerous documented cases, and that's part of their concerted strategy to distort religion and enable it to become a sword to harm other people, and to transform it from how it was originally intended as a shield to allow people to believe or not as they choose and to practice those beliefs, but not in a way that harms others in our shared spaces. Mm-hmm. Because it just to keep talking for a minute, Amy, because how can the American experiment, which is very intentionally diverse, religiously diverse, racially diverse, more vibrantly diverse today than ever, how can that experiment survive if when we come together in the public square, we use our religious beliefs to discriminate against and cause harm to our sisters and brothers? Like, how does that society proceed constructively, civilly, and peacefully? Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of a problem that's inherent in, that's actually, it's a danger that we're dealing with now more than ever today, because there's this trifecta right now in our country. There's this effort in the courts, and we've seen it with Masterpiece, with all these other cases we've been talking about, to allow religion to be weaponized to discriminate. We see it in a state strategy. I don't know if you're aware of what Religious News Services and Frederick Clarkson exposed as this project that's been existent for some time. It's called Project Blitz. And it's a state strategy to build towards allowing discrimination in the states through passing laws as part of a three-step strategy. This article in Religious News Services exposed that there's a 116-page playbook, which was created by the Congressional Prayer Caucus Foundation. And it's a guide for state legislators to basically ensure that this country becomes a Christian nation through the government in three phases, right? The first phase is just to pass sort of this lower hanging fruit of In God We Trust bills that just put In God We Trust everywhere they possibly can, on police cars, just sort of anywhere. Mm-hmm. The second phase, and they admit that that phase is really hard to challenge because it's just sort of symbolic and it's hard to win against those bills. And it's an intentional phase one. Phase two is to sort of inculcate Christianity in public schools. And lo and behold, we've seen 26 bills introduced this year in state legislatures allowing the posting of states' national mottos in public schools or buildings, like In God We Trust. And the third part of the strategy is to pass bills that permit discrimination in the name of religion, but carefully guised as civil rights violations against religious people. And it's, you know, it also, because it's a Congressional Prayer Caucus Foundation effort, they've been building relationships and caucuses in the states. So, for example, there are 65 public officials on board in Iowa and 28 already on board in Tennessee. There's 20 model bills in their 116-page playbook, and an effort is underway. So there's the sort of Alliance Defending Freedom Court part of this effort to use religion to cause harm to others. There's the Project Blitz state legislative part. And then there's the Trump-Pence administration part, who have taken, you know, what was once maybe just a religiously based movement, and of course not a movement endorsed remotely by all Christians. And I always think that's a really important, I know you're with me on this, but a really important distinction to make. Mm-hmm. You know, a movement that grew out of just one part of a Christian religious community, not all parts. There's many parts for whom this type of effort violates their Christian beliefs. So it came out of one religious community, maybe, but now it's made its way into a wing of the politically conservative movement. And the Trump-Pence administration has fully embraced it. The Trump-Pence Department of Justice released a blueprint for discrimination early in his tenure. And we've seen that be implemented throughout many of the agencies. And the one that really is a standout is Health and Human Services, where we saw the interim final rules that allowed bosses and universities to deny birth control to women on the basis of religion. Mm-hmm. And that we, you know, that we've challenged, and that one's still in the courts. We've seen as well a refusal of care rule that's come down that would allow not just sort of doctors and nurses, but schedulers and janitors and everyone associated, insurers, to deny services, including emergency services, to people, and, you know, based on their religious beliefs. And we know that these types of rules target people who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, queer, transgender, that they tend to target women seeking reproductive health services. But we also know that they can be used to deny an interfaith couple fertility treatment and, you know, have other types of nefarious outcomes that maybe people don't realize that they permit. So that's the trifecta, right? The court effort, the effort in the state legislatures, and frankly, the federal legislature, which sort of bleeds into the third prong, which is the Trump-Pence administration effort to allow religion to be used to discriminate. And, you know, I didn't even mention Betsy DeVos and, you know, what's been going on, the unprecedented $1 billion budget that came out of the president's budget this year for school, private school vouchers, and which we know, you know, at least 80% of those funds, of those taxpayer funds, go to religious schools. And, you know, in many states, a much higher percentage goes straight to religious schools. And that's another piece of this sort of Trump-Pence administration effort. So I think it's really important that everybody pause a minute and realize that this is a coordinated campaign to allow religion and distort religion to be able to be weaponized as a tool for discrimination against other people. And that's what we're fighting for right now. We're fighting for the true meaning of religious freedom for all, which means this isn't about creating a white Christian nation. This isn't about one set of religious views, like in the Masterpiece case, that get to be imposed on the rest of us and carve out exceptions to anti-discrimination laws. This is about coexisting in an intentionally diverse nation and allowing everybody's religious views to matter the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like you've given us a dozen new issues to to take a look at in the future on the podcast. But thank you so much for being willing to spend some time walking us through the case and the affiliated issues for this week.
It's been great talking with you, and I hope we keep doing it.
Nish and I have both been wanting to bring Julie Rogers on the show for a while, but I won the coin toss and had a chance to chat with her this week. She's a thoughtful, delightful woman of deep faith who made national news a few years back when Wheaton College hired her to be the school's first chaplain to LGBT students, and then quickly changed its mind in the face of pressure from some alumni, forcing her out of the job. I spoke with Julie about a piece she wrote for the New York Times in May called What I Learned from Gay Conversion Therapy. It covers some of the time she spent as a teenager and a 20-something in evangelical communities that urge LGBT Christians to, quote, leave homosexuality. We also talked about what it was like for Julie to march in her first Pride parade this year as part of a church group, and about her upcoming wedding at the Washington Cathedral. So, Julie, thank you so much for joining us. We have been wanting to have you on since your op-ed ran in the New York Times. And then for Pride Month, we thought this was a perfect time, especially since we just saw the happiest, most joyful photos of you marching in DC Pride with the Washington Cathedral. That was pretty amazing. Tell me about how that experience came about and what that was like.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, it's so exciting to talk about and think about. And I'm in the midst of wedding planning, so I'm just all giddy about all things pride and celebration. My fiance and I, Amanda Height, go to the cathedral quite a bit. We're pretty involved there. It's just been a really safe, beautiful, vibrant congregation and community, and a safe place for us to worship. And neither of us have ever been in a pride parade before. We've never marched. And we thought, gosh, when we found out the cathedral was marching, we thought, how amazing is it that they're there to bear witness to the love of Jesus for all these people who have historically been told that God didn't love people like them. And we really just wanted to support that sort of effort and show our thanks and gratitude for their posture. So we kind of decided to do it. And I mean, honestly, I was a little bit of a drag about it. I was it's hot and we have to wait so long.
It is always one of the hottest weekends in DC.
Yeah, I was totally negative Nancy about it. And then finally, after a couple hours, we start marching and I cried at least 4 times. I got really choked up because it was just so incredibly moving to see all these people lining up on the streets, cheering for us and celebrating and just delighting in the equality and humanity of LGBT people. And I think for so long, when you feel so much shame about, and I felt so much shame about this part of who I am, and spent so long trying to hide it and to change it, and self-conscious about how I looked, and am I dressing too gay? Am I sitting gay right now? And then to march with my fiance and our church, and to just see people lining up to cheer for us was incredibly moving and powerful. And the other thing that was really powerful was seeing the faces on so many people who, when they saw that we were a church and they saw our signs, their face would just turn into this emotional reaction that said oh, you see me, you're here for me, you all are here for us. And that was really, truly profound, to just see this sense of connection where there's been such division and discord historically. It was powerful, Amy. It was so powerful.
Yeah. My church in DC, Calvary Baptist, has for, I think now a dozen years, both marched in the parade and had a booth throughout the weekend. And one of the things they do every year is offer communion. And one of the most powerful experiences I've had has been watching people come up just with tears streaming down their faces and saying, I haven't had communion in decades. I left the church. I didn't feel accepted. I thought this was something I'd never be able to do before. And it is so just fulfilling. But also, the flip side of that is how devastating to know the hurt that the church has caused. And you personally obviously know both sides of that. So I guess I'm wondering, I can only imagine just the feeling of affirmation from marching in your first Pride parade on its own, but to do that with a religious community, what was the importance of that for you?
Yeah, gosh, I underestimated how emotionally just how important it would be for me to be in a community that celebrated and delighted in me without question or qualification. I think I spent a long time in Christian communities that, you know, tried to preach a nicer message than we heard in like the 80s and 90s, you know, than I heard when I was a kid. And I think I learned to settle for that sort of love and to just say, hey, this is the most that people can offer me is, you know, we love you and we disagree with this, you know, with that behavior. And so you just kind of learn to, or I probably did, one coping mechanism that I developed was just to sort of accept that and say, okay, like these breadcrumbs from the table are enough for me. But it just pales in comparison to walking in and seeing people, you know, seeing your minister, your pastor or priest light up when they see you and your partner together and to just hug you and to ask how things are going and to offer support, you know, for us in our relationship to help us become better Christians. And I feel like for so long, you know, my sexuality was the big problem in a lot of my Christian communities. And that was the whole focus almost. It's just like not acting on my gayness. And in churches like the cathedral and in communities that are fully affirming, since that's like a non-issue, we get to talk about like how I can be like more generous and less selfish and how I can really embody the spirit and call of Jesus. And I just feel, it feels so freeing and also an invitation into growth in different ways related to my faith.
That is such an interesting point that in some ways makes so much sense, but I haven't heard a lot of folks articulate it that way, that you can be more free to focus on your faith and actually growing as a Christian if not every conversation is focused on how you really need to hide this part of yourself.
Yeah, it is. It's really wild.
And it seems like something that's really, you know, sadly overlooked by all of the Christian communities that that aren't able to just embrace all of you.
Yeah, it is. It's really wild, Amy. Like I think especially my fiance and I have been, you know, really like in the throes of wedding planning and doing food tasting and, you know, premarital counseling and all these things. And it's been such a joy and it's been so fun to see her just joy and generosity in inviting way too many people and wanting to just, she's such a enthusiastic giver. And in all of this, I've just been like, wow, like this is it. Like, this is what so many Christians and churches have devoted millions of dollars, thousands of books and conferences and all this. This is what they've been trying to work against and prevent. And it's just so fine. It's not only is it a good and beautiful thing, it's also just a boring thing. Like, we watch Netflix and we, you know, are eating dinner with friends and we hang out with our cats. And like, it's just so wild to me that that so much energy has gone into keeping people like us from coming together and sharing our lives together in a committed, long-term, Christ-centered way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, and you've been pretty open about this on social media, so I think we can discuss the fact that you're actually getting married at the National Cathedral, which is crazy.
Yes, I'm so excited. Amanda is one of those people that is over the top might be too strong, but she just does everything to the max. Yes, there's nothing that she does halfway. And so she had a vision and a dream that we were going to get married there. And I was just kind of like, you know, we could just go to the courthouse and like, you know, get a certificate with a couple friends. And, you know, I once again kind of was like, dragging my feet a little bit, being an introvert about it. But gosh, the priest, Dana Corsello, who's going to marry us, when she responded to a friend of ours, question of whether or not it was even a possibility for us to get married there, Dana responded enthusiastically and didn't just say it was a possibility and she could connect us with someone, but she said, I would be honored to marry them. I would love to be the one who gets to marry them. And it has been profoundly moving to me to just be so, so deeply celebrated and welcomed there and supported. And so that has, like, that pastoral care has been such a surprise, and in sort of vital part of this for us, but then also just, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous place. And I am, like, all in now and so happy and so thankful that, we're getting this opportunity, and we're just gonna, have kind of, like I was saying about pride, but on another level, where we're going to have friends and family who have seen us through so many different stages of struggling with this part of who we are. They're all going to be there, like, watching us and crying with us and celebrating us as we finally sort of live into the fullness of our desire to love somebody. And it's just going to be so powerful to do that in our nation's cathedral.
Well, Nish and I have one request for you, because we did not get a chance to do what we had hoped, which was live cast the Harry and Meghan wedding. So we are going to need a live stream of the Julie and Amanda wedding so that we can live cast it.
Well, luckily, Amanda works in the social media space, so she's awesome. Probably going to make that happen.
Done.
Well, before I let you go, I did want to talk about kind of the flip side of what you're experiencing now, and what we are so happy for you to be able to know now, which is the experience of a lot of LGBT folks in Christian communities that don't accept them, and more than just not accepting them, embrace approaches like conversion therapy. And one of the things that you wrote in your op-ed that was out, beginning of May, is that one of the ironies here is that in communities that don't believe in therapy in general, they pursue the idea that you can actually change who you are. But I want you to talk about what the actual lived experience is like, because, as you say, that ends up not being how it's felt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I spent almost a decade involved in, sort of ex-gay organizations, Christian conversion therapy. And what's interesting about what's happening around that issue is so many people think of it in legal terms, and there are some states with laws that ban conversion therapy for minors, at least. I believe 11 states at this point have laws that ban it for minors. But most of the conversion therapy that's happening at this point isn't done by licensed professional therapists. It's done by religious advisors and Christian ministers who are doing it in more of like a pastoral counseling role, which is obviously protected by religious liberty laws. So this isn't really something that can be changed, legally or in the courts, even though I am glad that, that people are seeking to do that where they can among therapists. But it's really interesting. The Williams Institute out of University of UCLA School of Law estimates, in a big recent study they've done, estimates that 57,000 youth who are currently between the ages of 13 and 17 will receive conversion therapy from a religious advisor before they turn 18. Wow. So that's and I'm sure that's something that's also underreported, because so many people don't see it as conversion therapy. For instance, the organization I was a part of for a long time, I was involved in weekly counseling in addition to weekly sort of healing prayer group, in addition to a weekly support group. So it's three times a week. And the sort of theory of why we were gay or why we experienced same-sex attraction was either that we had a sort of like broken connection to our same-sex parent, and that because of that broken relationship, we were seeking out that like connection and wholeness. Now it was through same-sex relationships or those desires. And if you were like, no, 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 I had a great relationship with my mom, or if a boy said that about his dad, they were like, you were probably sexually abused when you were younger, because these were like the two things that would cause it. And that obviously flies in the face of science. And there are a lot of straight people who have really poor relationships with their same-sex parent and experience sexual abuse, and they're still straight. So, but they were sort of teaching like the core principles of conversion therapy in these pastoral healing prayer groups, and we're doing a lot of prayer around those things, and that is conversion therapy essentially. But we wouldn't have known that or seen it that way at the time, because right. It was just presented as the truth.
Right. So there does sound like there's very good reason to think that's being underreported.
Yeah.
And the context of all of this is that while so much of these issues get debated and framed as religion versus the LGBT community, mm-hmm. We know, and there were new poll numbers out just last week, I believe, that more than half of LGBT folks in the U.S. are committed Christians who are part of a Christian community.
Yeah. Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
It's so wild. I mean, I don't know how I missed that for so long when I was in really conservative communities, that I think often like those communities were really sort of insular, and I wasn't exposed to people who were very different than me, who believe different, or even like I didn't have that many friends who were mainline Christians, who were Presbyterian USA or Episcopalian. And so when the leaders in those communities would tell me, oh, you know, gay people sort of enter into this lifestyle of debauchery and drug addiction and sex addiction, I believed them. I was like, oh, that's what it means to be gay. That's what happens if you sort of like accept who you are. You're sort of like giving into the flesh. But then I eventually came to a place of acceptance myself and started meeting people. And I constantly, as I'm out and about, just sort of in the broader LGBT community and sharing about my life and my story, you know, all these people come up to me like, oh my gosh, like me too. Like I came from a similar background, and I also continue to have this sort of spiritual questions and longings and desires. And I pray, and occasionally I go to this church, and, but I didn't know that that was really a movement, that there was like a place for me. And I think so often like conservative Christians and honestly a lot of times like the broader like media, who might not understand people of faith as well, frame it as you know, gays versus the Christians, but it's not true at all in my experience in the LGBT community.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that kind of brings us full circle back to Pride, because as you got a chance to see yourself this year, there are dozens and dozens of religious communities that march in Pride parades, both in D.C., here in Chicago, in New York, all over the country. And for those who want to see, that's as much proof as anything you need of the flourishing of religious love and teaching alongside full affirming and acceptance of LGBT Christians. So we are so happy for you and Amanda. We love you guys. And I'm so glad we could get you on the pod to chat with us.
Oh, it's so great chatting, Amy. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for what you and Nish are doing.
Thank you.
We'll close, as always, with our prayers and petitions segment. As a reminder, please, please send us a voice memo with something good happening in your life. We could all use a little light right now. You can email a voice memo to impolitewomen, that's all one word, @gmail.com. That's impolitewomen@gmail.com. Or if you're unsure about how to do that, drop us a line on Twitter and we'll walk you through it. As for me, I have spent a lot of the past week moving at the pace of a four-year-old, which is actually really good for the soul. We have gone to art festivals. We drank the juice from half of a watermelon. We spent a morning picking up trash in downtown Evanston because he wanted the earth to have a happy heart. We are going to feed ducks by the lake later today. And if we really go nuts, we'll get some bubble tea because that's his absolute favorite treat. I also have to shout out the large variety of products that you can buy on Etsy.com that say, "Not today, Satan," because listeners, it's that kind of year, isn't it? When I get really down about what's happening in the world, I buy another "Not Today, Satan" t-shirt. And at the rate things are going, that is pretty much all I'm going to own soon. That's all for this week's episode. Thanks for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you'd like to support the show, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/impolitecompany and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand these conversations. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids!